another episode of What You Doin' Podcast, the interview podcast where I talk to amazing people about the cool projects that they're working on. My name is Matt. This week, I'm sitting down with Emmanuel Noel and Ray Chow to talk about their work on Cyber Plus Punk Overload, available now on Kickstarter. Cyber Plus Punk Overload is the expansion to the hit, I think I can say hit, TTRPG Cyber Plus Punk, designed by Emmanuel and published by Ray by way of MythWorks, where you play a group of cyberpunk mercenaries taking on one last job before they give it all up. We get into it a bit in the interview, but I love Cyber Plus Punk's design, focus, energy. It really speaks to me as a game, as a product, and I was so excited to get Emmanuel and Ray on the show together. This one took a little bit because of some personal stuff going on, but hey, let's not waste any more time. Let's get into it. Hey everybody, welcome to What You Doin' Podcast, the interview podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing things that they're working on. My name is Matt. I'm here today with Emmanuel and Ray. Say hi.
Hi.
We're here today to talk about Cyber Plus Punk Overload, currently on Kickstarter, which, let me tell you, as I have the copy that I just bought the other day, I'm very excited about. It looks incredible. Before we get too deep into it, because sometimes I'd let my mouth get ahead of me, let's do our intros. Start with Emmanuel. Emmanuel.
Hey everyone, I'm Emmanuel Mello. I'm he, him. I'm the creator of Cyber Plus Punk and a few other smaller things as well. I'm a huge RPG fan, especially narrative ones. And let's talk about it. Let's talk about Cyber Plus Punk and other things.
Heck yeah. And Ray.
Everyone, my name is Ray Chow, he, him pronouns as well, and I am one of the co-founders of MythWorks, which is a publishing company focused on comics and games like Cyber Plus Punk Augmented Edition, narrative games that Emmanuel likes, and I'm stoked to be talking about cyberpunk and all sorts of other things as well.
You know, look, I played my hand a little bit. I'm so excited for this new version. I remember when... my sort of friend group was talking about Cyber Plus Punk, and it sounds like a silly thing to say, but like, it's so immediately visually grabbing with the design, like the physical design, like as a physical product, it is amazing. And as a game, it continues to be amazing. And I think like, I hope in so many ways, I hope a lot of people take inspiration from it as what of doing a lot with a little. I sat down and like finally flipped through it. Now that I finally have a physical copy, I sat down and like had it in my hands, and it's so dense there's not a wasted bit of space in that whole thing. Emmanuel, how did that? You know, was that a thing that you had when you started? You know, did you set out, you know, knowing that like, I want to design this really tight pamphlet style game? Or is it something that sort of came about near the end when you started working on layout and like, what does this thing actually look like?
Yeah, it started more like a challenge for me. I wanted to streamline the Forge in the Dark system as much as I could. Mm-hmm. And by the end process, I mean, we never finish a thing. Like we have to force separate from it. So by the time I was like, okay, I think I'm stopping right here. But it's sometimes you have to maximize space, the space you have. Like it was just a pamphlet with three panels, six panels if you count the other side of the sheet. So we have to maximize by choosing the right words that evoke some kind of setting, some kind of feeling and mood that you want people to feel and when reading and playing through the game. But I also found that if I adjusted the visuals to match the team as well as much as I could, and write smaller things on the margins and use some symbols and that kind of stuff. I could also enhance the experience and the immersion in the game. So that was almost an afterthought after I finished designing, writing the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a thing I noticed flipping through the pamphlets and a couple of the rules plugins is the use of iconography in a way that doesn't happen a lot in TTRPGs, but is really, really common in board games and card games, of like, here's this term or set of words that we're going to use over and over and over again. Hey, instead of that, here's a little symbol that I think, like you said, like, plays into the setting in a really fun way. I'm a sucker for TTRPGs that are hyper specific, that know exactly what sort of story they want to tell and just barrel straight down on how to tell that story. Cyberpunk as a genre is a very well trodden road. What was your inspiration to, you know, in so many words, make another one? You know, I never want to come across as like, oh, you shouldn't make whatever. But what was your sort of inspiration moment for, you know, taking Forged in the Dark in a sort of like more realistic, kind of gritty cyberpunk direction?
Yeah, I had a group of friends. We were trying smaller systems, and one day one of these friends asked me to run a cyberpunk team game, whatever the system I was going to choose. So I figured, like, but I don't want to play Cyberpunk, I want to play Blaze in the Dark. How can I do this? And then I was like, of course, I will try to find some Blaze in the Dark hack with that Cyberpunk team. And there was one called Hack the Planet, and I read through, and it's a very good game, but still we are playing like smaller games, and I felt like we wouldn't have the time to explain the gist of it in just one session. So I spent like 2 weeks trying to trim down the core of the Forged in the Dark roles and action roles and that kind of stuff, just to play that one session. And it ended up we had a blast with it, and I was like, okay, I'm going to develop more and try to blow this to a bigger system, like I was just trying to get into the pamphlet making. The RPG pamphlets were much more a thing. There was a surge, especially here in Brazil, and I was trying to get something out, and I saw that as an opportunity. And also, I really like cyberpunk as a setting, as a genre, so it was like a pleasure to dive deep into the setting for this. So I wasn't caring much about if I was making just another one cyberpunk game. I was caring about just expanding on that home game we had, that one night that we had so much fun. And I wanted to share that with more people, and perhaps some more people that like cyberpunk and was soon going to be discovering the Forged in the Dark engine through it. So it was like a double feature, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think you've brought some interesting stuff to it. I was reading through the Weird plugin, which for people who don't know, for Cyber Plus Punk, there is no sort of shadow run, you know, goblinization magic stuff as an inherent assumption for the setting. But then there's a plus Weird plugin that you can get that adds that. And I appreciated the way that you went through and recapped, in I think a pretty clean and straightforward way, like how it works, how you want it to work in this game, and kind of hitting some of the big notes. Because I have found in the past that people love playing Shadowrun in any system other than Shadowrun. And sometimes people's hesitation with that game is all of that setting stuff that is, you know, comes along with it. So I was happy to see that represented as like in an additive way. A lot like I think you're adding psionics in with the new Kickstarter.
Yeah. During the campaign, we are having this new pamphlet called Psychotronics that adds psionics and some psionic gear and drawbacks and consequence, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I love that sort of modular additive design, because I love being the guy at the table, you know, when you're making characters and talk about stuff that's like, all right, guys, look, I was on Reddit and I found a weird PDF, right? Okay, you know, I love being that guy that's like, all right, well, everybody, we got to add a whole new rules thing because I want to be weird about it.
Yeah, I'm almost like that as well. One of these days, I was like to my GM, I was like asking, how about if, would you accept as a D&D race or ancestry, would you accept a mimic? Because I really want to play a mimic.
Everybody has that. Everybody has that urge one day. We're just like, no, I want to be weird with it right now. Let's, is everybody cool? Can we all be cool real quick? And it's great. I love it. And the fun of like lighter rule systems is making calls like that, making shifts like that is a lot easier, you know, for sort of everybody on the table. Shifting gears a little bit, because I don't want Ray to be sitting there all by himself. From a production side, Ray, I have to imagine a pamphlet, not even just a pamphlet set has to be incredibly complex in terms of logistics and all of this. What was I don't want to say what was the risk, but how did you feel about Cyber Plus Punk like at the start of it?
To answer your question first, we'll kind of go bit by bit here. So, actually, it's a lot simpler than you would imagine, especially when you have someone on Emmanuel, you know, on your team designing everything. The manufacturing component of the game is easier in many ways than other types of RPGs, which are traditionally books, at least in the sense that it's from a cost standpoint, it is actually cheaper to manufacture pamphlets than it is to manufacture a full, you know, 100, 200, 300 page per saddle stitch book. The difficulty lies in the design of the product, and luckily, you know, Emmanuel is an amazing product designer. He is the type of designer who not only designs the game rules, but is, you know, like an auteur in many ways. So is literally making cardboard mock-ups with his knives at home to show the manufacturer and to take videos and say, this is exactly what we would like to do. Please tell us if you can do this and how much it would be. So from that standpoint, the difficult work is all done by Emmanuel, like 100% done by Emmanuel. So he makes it very, very easy. To go further than that, some of the really fun things that we do in Cyber Plus Punk is we have a really, really elaborate spot gloss and spot UV layer. Sometimes we use it for just being able to make it dry erase compatible. For instance, if you make it spot gloss, that instantly makes something dry erase compatible, just something I did not know before doing the project. But Emmanuel and the rest of the artists on the team, they use it to enhance a lot of the visuals in really cool and fun and interesting ways. If you open up like the box and go through the cover art, especially of some of the pamphlets, you'll notice that there's a really, really cool layer in all of that. So from a production standpoint, it's actually not too bad. It's actually in a lot of ways a cheaper product to manufacture than books, and therefore, from a business standpoint, makes it a better product in many ways than doing it as a book. And to kind of answer, I guess, or get into the broader question of how I got involved or what I thought about CBR plus BNK, I saw it fairly early on, and I, you know, I was pretty blown away from it. I think I was like on day one or day two of when it was released on itch, and I bought it and I downloaded the original version right away. And at the time, I was very deeply involved in There's three things going on in my life at the time. Number one, I was super, super heavily involved in the Forge in the Dark community, especially in the Blades Discord. And I was designing a bunch of games and getting into the discourse of designing games and just trying to wrap my mind around Blades in the Dark and Forge in the Dark as a system, which is an incredibly complex clockwork system of rules. Number two, I was obsessed with Cyberpunk 2077 at the time, and I played a lot of that game and was in love with the game and the story of that game. So I had Cyberpunk on my mind, and I think this was like 2020 or shortly afterwards. So, you know, like Black Lives Matter was going on, like all of this stuff that we're seeing, like echoing now, especially I live in Los Angeles, so like a lot of that stuff was like front and center, and just sort of like the nature of our like cyberpunk like reality basically. And number three, because it was lockdown, I was missing going to festivals and parties a lot, and which is a big part of my life. So I was like thinking about that aspect of my life that was missing. And so Emmanuel came out with Cyberpunk, and I think I had a weekly playtest group with a bunch of Forge in the Dark designers in there, one of which is Michael Elliott, is actually one of the contributors to this project for Overload. And we had a rotating GM system, much like Emmanuel had his group where they would try various small systems, we would try various systems too. We started off playing everyone's games, and once we cycled through all of our games, then we were play other systems. So I brought Cyberpunk Augmented to the table, and I wrote a module for it called Wonderland, which was a rave-based scenario. And I ran it for them. It was really fun. I felt really inspired to do that. I thought it was a really, really good scenario, one of the best scenarios that I've written. And I found out later that, like, I guess it was the first, like, scenario that someone had written for Cyberpunk, which is pretty cool. And, you know, I had posted about it on the Blades Discord. So that was kind of a cool moment. So, you know, I was just a big early fan and player in Cyberpunk Augmented. And later when I began publishing RPGs, you know, I naturally thought, I was like, well, Cyberpunk was really cool. Let's see if Emmanuel has any plans to turn that into a physical product. So, you know, DM'd him and got that conversation going. And that's how I got involved in the project.
See, that's interesting. I didn't know that the sort of digital version came first. That's I would have thought it feels so physical in its design. You know, it feels so intentionally made to be a physical thing in front of you that you're interacting with. I wouldn't have thought that it went the other way. Was there sort of a redesign process, Emmanuel, after you had started working on the physical version, or was it kind of always intended to be printed in a physical way when you were designing the digital files?
Yeah, when I was doing the digital files, the first version, I was thinking about how would people would print this at home, not just use it on their tablets or phones, but print at home to use as a physical thing. So it was much easier to translate that to the augmented version by MythWorks. But also we did some changes, like we added some panels, we reworked some of the graphics, we did some covers by Luis Melo, a very talented artist, and there was some redesign, graphical speaking. But also I always, when I'm doing anything, I'm always thinking about the physical product, because I really like the physicality of things. I really like to touch and feel and use all the graphic enhancements that we can. Like if Discover needs an UV layer to make that coating shiny, or some different kind of paper, the paper texture really matters to me. All of these things, I'm always thinking about this when I design anything. So when Ray presented me the opportunity to work with MythWorks to bring this to print in a pamphlet format, I already had some ideas, and I showed him a few pictures that I've collected from the internet, like, what about something like this or that? It was really fun, a really fun process.
I love that. I love the story, like, I don't know if this is common knowledge. I didn't know this. I just love I love the story of like you designing this game and Ray finding it and loving it, and then like later after doing MythWorks, like, here, you know what I'm gonna do? You know what? I gotta go back. I gotta and help this game that I loved. And I think that's such a great like a thing I talk about. It comes up every episode. I'm sure people are sick of hearing about it. Is the effort that I think is so important for people who are fans of things to take to boost it, to help it find new people, to find new eyes, to find new people involved. And I love that, like, that's why this product exists, is Ray found a thing that he loved, and then he had the opportunity to, you know, bring it to market, bring it to new people, get new people excited about it. And then now we have this, and then, you know, here we are talking about even the second Kickstarter. That's awesome. I love that.
The second Kickstarter is happening just because of that. Because when we had the augmented version, the print going out to people, to their homes, and finally people getting to that, we launched a Cyberpunk Gen, and on itch.io, which if you don't know, it's a website where we publish digital versions of the games. And sometimes we do these gems to for people to engage with the community as a community, to bring some new materials, hacks, etc. So we opened that gem, and there was so much cool material coming out. And we did that a second time the year later. And we collect all this for Overload, and the ones we think that stand out, we collect this and bring this sometimes first time authors to this new package with their own pamphlets, their own vision for Cyberpunk.
That you got ahead of me. I was gonna say, it was like, what was kind of the idea for this new Kickstarter? So that's perfect. Is there anything that you've seen in these jams that you've had a moment like, as the person who designed it, I'm always curious about this, like, was there anything that somebody wrote that you're like, damn, I should have thought of that, like, that's good, you know, stuff you almost like want to add? I mean, I guess you are adding it into the quote-unquote core product, because you're publishing it under the name, right? But have you seen anything that you're like, I wish I'd thought of that? That's good.
Every pamphlet we are publishing now for Overload has something that we are sure we will add a lot to the whole game. But one guy did something that I could never ever imagine, and it was Leonardo Azevedo, who was on the first box with Mona Rise Megalopolis. He did something with these two new pamphlets, Basilisk and Son of a Glitch, which are adding a layer of digital files to the players to solve some mysteries that are going on with their pamphlet, in the story of the pamphlet, the adventure he written. So you find these layers, and the GM is supposed to send to you, to your device, physically, your person, for you to try to find the password for that. So you navigate a layer of digital files on your device to solve the run. So it's a very interesting layer he adds to the gameplay.
And that's fun.
Yeah, you should see the diagrams he makes, like, to explain where each file goes and how do you find each password. It's amazing. And very cyberpunk.
And then the idea that, like, all of that is still able to fit in this pamphlet, like, before this even, you know, I've come across a few TTRPG pamphlets, but just, like, it doesn't feel like a lot of space if you look at it, right? It doesn't feel like you'd be able to get too much in. But I guess a lot of that is just, you know, like you said at the beginning, a lot of that is design and layout and intention and, you know, how you put things together. I'm so excited to see this new package, because I think it's a really exciting mix of things you would want for this sort of game, right? It's a mix of here's some adventures, here's some new rules and options and things, and then just things that are like, you know, would be settings for other games of like, here's, you know, not even just one adventure, here's a thing you could do multiple adventures there. You know, you could run, you know, these, you know, missions in this for however many sessions you want. And I think for smaller, more intentional games, that's so much more exciting than it would, not that you even would, it would be so weird to follow up a product with like, here's a big 200 page setting book, right? That would be wild to be like, here's a big book, have a good time. But it feels, it's so exciting to keep that theme of, yeah, here's like, here, you know, what are we doing tonight? Here we go. I got it. I got this one little pamphlet. That's all we need. Let's keep it moving. And then again, the design, I watched the Kickstarter video before we got together. All of the pamphlets being in the little boxes, and then all of the boxes being, man, get out of here with that. Get out of here. What were you excited to do something new with the physical product, or was this a manufacturing concern? Like what brought you to say it's going to be different? How did it come into little boxes?
I think Ray wants to talk about that.
There's one line in the Kickstarter that's quite important, which is design not finalized, which is important because there are this relates to your earlier question too. So in the process, I actually just got quotes back from various manufacturers today about Overload and the manufacturing. So one of the things that we did not realize, or we kind of anticipated, but we didn't anticipate the full impact, is doing things in three boxes actually is one small box is the same price as one big box from a manufacturing standpoint, at least when you go from, you know, like a thin quarter inch box to an inch box, it's about the same price versus one versus three. So we found out today, just about a couple hours before we started this call, that having three boxes means that we'd pay essentially almost three times the price for the product, because the box is the most expensive component in the entire Cyberpunk package. So we may have to go back to the drawing board when it comes to the three small boxes ideas. So we're thinking now, and Manuel brainstormed up, oh, maybe we'll do like have one box but with three different sleeves in there. So, you know, that's kind of like the reality of manufacturing sometimes, is that like we have like pie in the sky ideas and like we want to sort of go for all the time, especially at MythWorks. If you know like our other products, like we always try to do like some kind of crazy cool stuff and innovative stuff, but sometimes the manufacturing realities present challenges where we have to sort of go back to the box. And, you know, I'm sure we'll figure out a really cool solution to make it a really, really cool presentation, but and communicate with everybody what those are. But yeah, just one of the many challenges of making things like this.
Right. And specifically the struggle of needing to the fun, like not even just balance, but like triangle balance of trying to make a cool product that's also affordable and also catches people's eyes on Kickstarter, you know, and that weird like triple balance, like there's no perfect, it's just where can you find it. That, yeah, gosh, part of what I love about this show is getting to talk to people like involved in the manufacturing process, involved in like the background and the creation stuff, because I feel like there's so much of the process that people A, don't talk about, B, don't think about, or C, don't know until they actually get into it and are part of it and involved. You know, when I was talking with Andy from Pandion, he was talking about, you know, sort of the early days of Kickstarter, that big surge where so many people oversold, so many people overpromised and all of this. And I think, you know, I want to say that there were probably not a lot of people that set out to scam people, right? Just, you know, my hope is that. I think what happened is a lot of people got really excited, like, you know, like you said, Ray, like had really big pie in the sky ideas. And then got the money and then went and spoke to somebody involved in manufacturing and were like, well, we have to deliver what we promised, you know, and didn't realize that it was going to cost, you know, X much more or so much more or whatever. And then just, you know, did what they could instead of saying, you know, hey, this is what we want to do. We'll see if we can afford it. And we'll, you know, we'll work towards it. Gosh, yeah. I love the idea. I like the idea of just on a little byline, like, yeah, that box, this much. Three boxes? Hang on. Nobody orders three boxes. Get out of here.
Yeah. I think, and this is a bit of a tangent, but I think what's really interesting about crowdfunding and where it's at in 2025 is crowdfunding has been a concept now or something that's been around for about 17 years, I think. Kickstarter launched in 2008. And when Kickstarter launched as a brand new platform, people were so excited about what it was and the possibilities of these creative projects. And there definitely has been an evolution in crowdfunding, just like there's an evolution with every sort of platform, especially digital platforms that we see. And for me, sort of doing what I do and just, you know, like being part of that history and observing it intimately, it's so fascinating to see how this space has evolved. I would say, like, you know, let's say 2011, 2012, right? Like every time when the platform launches, there's so much opportunity because people are excited about what it could bring, right? What these things that are being brought forth, and not just opportunity, but trust. There's so much trust in the process, like optimism, almost like blind optimism, because, you know, it feels like, and I think this was the promise of crowdfunding when it first launched, it feels like you're doing a good thing when you back a Kickstarter project. At least it did back then. It feels like you're supporting independent artists who are and you're helping them make their dreams come true. And to a large extent, that is very true, or was very true. And I think what's happened over time is, sometimes people have overpromised and underdelivered, and that's just the reality of the situation, because making things is difficult. Making mm-hmm. things at scale is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Combining really where Kickstarter lies is where the art meets the business side of things, and fundamentally these things are constantly opposed to one another, right? Like we're constantly having to balance what those things are, and I think a whole generation of creators learned that lesson the hard way, myself included, and those who continue to do it, a lot of times, especially in the game space, what you see is those creators evolve into companies, right? And like, oh, now we have this wherewithal, we know how to do these things, but even then it becomes, you know, it is still very perilous. Like, you know, there's news about like Cool Mini or not, right? And how they're just selling off brands right now, and it's just like, oh, they're probably like a little bit overextended and need to really, you know, tighten up or whatever. But still, like the opportunity exists and it especially existed early on. We saw a whole generation of creators become publishers or other businesses, right? I'm thinking about like Stonemaier, I'm thinking about like Magpie. And once that happens though, more and more people flock to that platform. But as more and more people flock to that platform and more people have experience backing Kickstarters, some of that optimism, some of that like, oh, we're doing a good thing, kind of goes away. And nowadays, I really admire what Andy and Pandion is doing, because they're a newer creator. They've only started doing crowdfunders since like 2020 or 2021, I think. And really, it's the last like couple of projects that they've done that have like really taken off, and they're on like a really amazing trajectory now. But seeing them succeed, their path starting much later was much more difficult than like, say, my path, where I started doing comics on Kickstarter in 2014, and back then it's like is way easier, right? Like there was less projects, there was the expectations were lower because people still had some of that optimism. And, you know, it was easier to sort of ride that wave. Whereas these days, because it's been around for 17 years, it's like, well, first of all, there's like so many platforms to choose from, right? If you're launching a board game project in 2025, do you go with Kickstarter? Do you go with GameFound? Do you go with BackerKit? What are the pros and cons? I just had a creator ask me, like, what do you think are the differences between Kickstarter and BackerKit? Since you're on both, and I told them honestly, like, I need to get back to you on that because that is a constantly changing conversation. Like, it is impossible to say, like, every 3 months that changes, right? But not only that, it's like once you do pick a platform, the expectations for you as a creator, because all of these companies have like professionalized the Stonemaiers, the Magpies of the world. And, you know, I'll throw ourselves into there as well, where we've sort of like professionalized and we have processes and have like these standards now and like know how to get things done. They raise the bar, right? And not only that, but then you have existing companies who have already been in the space, entering the space, and, you know, bringing their processes. So like it's the expectation now for a Kickstarter for backing a project is like, you know, you're expected to have to do a lot more and to have a lot more done, right? So as a new creator, it's like, oh, I have to reach up here instead of being able to gradually on ramp and learn how to go up. And I'm not saying that it's not impossible, but it certainly is so interesting to see how it's evolved. And and now it's just sort of, it's not necessarily, I don't think anybody in 2025 is like saying, like, is excited about like a crowdfunded project in the same way that they were in 2011, 2012, at least in the sense of like, oh, wow, what's this, right? This is such a cool new thing. But really, it's just an expectation of like, okay, you kind of have to do it. If you're serious about like board games or RPGs, and I know there's a couple of projects that don't, but the reality is, and I know because I've had these conversations with other publishers, distributors, or whatever, is that if you're not doing a crowdfunder, you're leaving a huge chunk of your overall potential like on the table, like just flat out, right? And so unless you have like a major backing, unless you're with like Asmodee or something like that, it's like, why you're just simply cutting off a huge part of what you could be doing if you don't go on crowdfunders. I know that was like totally not here or there, but
No, that's fine. That's, I mean, that gets to a thing I've thought about over the last couple of years with Kickstarter, exactly like you said, becoming less of a ooh, what's this new thing, you know, exciting way to discover new things, and almost feeling like the default in a lot of ways. It's a thing I've thought about over the last couple of years of it almost feels, you know, exactly like you said, if you're launching specific types of products, kind of almost regardless of what you're doing, you need to have a crowdfunder because it's so much of, you know, obviously you have to do a lot of your own work, but being able to get that like Kickstarter projects we love. And like, that's that, at least to me, who's, you know, as I say a lot, like, I'm not a professional in the industry. I have no like professional insight. It feels so much like it's a lot of built-in marketing. It's a lot of built-in eyes on your project, regardless of, you know, it's one of those things of, you know, if 1% of people that see your project back it, getting everything you do to get everyone, as many people to see it as you can, you know, building into that ecosystem, becoming a part of that, getting on these emailing lists, getting on these, you know, these people who, it feels like there's a lot of people who use Kickstarter who are just like, what are the new projects? And just go through and, you know, and find new stuff and back it just because like, oh, that seems cool, I'll get it. And so, yeah, I've wondered for a little bit if you're launching a book or a TTRPG or a comic or, you know, smaller project. Do people do music on Kickstarter? Probably. I don't know. I've literally never looked, but I feel like it, you know, unless you are, like you said, like Asmodee, you're a company that has these manufacturers and you know, the money and backing built in, you just have to. So that's good to hear confirmed. I like when I have a thought that I don't express to anybody, and then someone who is smart and has a lot of experience is like, you know, has the same thought. I'm like, oh, I was right. Cool. So for Overload, for the new Kickstarter, you talked about, you know, running the game jams and all of that. Was the Kickstarter a, hey, we have so much, we have so many amazing people that we want to work with. Let's, you know, bring all that together and make a product and make something exciting. Was that a, hey, we want to make another product eventually, and you realized you had this glut of talent, you know, and you put one and two together? Like, what was kind of the chain of thought for how we got to here?
Yeah, a bit of both. It's something that the fan base has been asking for a long time. Like, you know, we'll always have people come up, be like, hey, do you guys have more scenarios? How come you don't have more stuff? And we always point it online. It's like, well, you can get like a lot of stuff online. If you go on Itch, we have these game jams. There's all these one-off scenarios. And people would be like, well, why don't you sell them? Why aren't you making more of them? And, you know, it kind of made sense to us because we had so much material, so many pamphlets, and just the nature of the game, because it is a one-shot thing. Like, personally, when I run it, I love just being able to have a scenario on one pamphlet, right? Like, that's so ideal for me. And as someone who runs a lot of like scenarios and less so like kind of a come up with original stuff, but like adapt stuff GM, like that's just sort of the material I want. So I think it was a combination of that, you know, being asked by fans a lot when we in person at cons, and having these game jams and these wonderful scenarios that were really cool and stuff that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily think of ourselves, led to kind of the decision to make the expansion set and to try to, you know, work with all of these designers and to bring it out into the world a little bit more.
What do you feel like as you know, as both a creative and like, you know, the manufacturer, like, you know, a creator and quote unquote a company, what do you feel like when somebody comes to you at a convention and something like that and is like, why don't you have more product to sell?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good problem to have, I suppose, because, you know, it means that they really dig what you're doing, and mm-hmm. there's an expectation there that you should have more of it. Yeah, it's a bit of, you know, I think the best way to take it is as a compliment, as just like, okay, like, people like our stuff and want more of it, and we should try to make more of it in as timely a manner as we can.
Is there like... is there a feeling where you feel like it hits a boiling point or a tipping point where you're like, okay, well, now we gotta, like, I'm hearing enough people are asking, we gotta get something going? Or is it you kind of always are working in the background of trying to put an idea for the next thing together?
Well, okay, so creatively, when Emmanuel put together those jams, every time he put one of those jams up, it was like, okay, well, now we gotta do, we definitely gotta do a scenario, basically, right? Or mm-hmm. try to do it. So a lot of the material in Overload included. So I wrote Wonderland, that rave scenario that I was talking about earlier. Emmanuel decided to lay that out and design it for the first game jam, which was really, really like an honor from him to do it. It was like quite the compliment. And then my partner, Vince, but the co-founder at MythWorks, he put together Tremont Plaza for that jam. And then for the second jam, or maybe it was the first jam, but I wanted to do another scenario. So I came up with another scenario called Dark City, which is like kind of a Running Man scenario, right? And because like I just wanted to participate, wanted to make sure to support the jam, and also because I have like a lot of ideas for cyberpunk stuff. So we did that one. And then for the second jam, my partner did Netscape, which is kind of like a Matrix plugin. It adds a lot of cool things that you could do with like virtual reality, augmented reality, and stuff like that. So really, like, a lot of it is coming from like almost a selfish creator point of view. It's like, well, we kind of want to see like our stuff out there and published as well. But yeah, I don't know. Like, we definitely, the jams helped with like having lots of content. Emmanuel, any insights into this question?
Yeah. Once I get into the mindset, you can't just not have ideas, right? You just keep piling up those weird notes and those small ideas, and eventually they build into something more poppable, more usable on the table. And I feel like one of the things good about that I feel good about working creatively and working on new quote unquote products is work with people that I admire. So when Ray said that he wanted someone to lay out Wonderland for the first gym, I was like, let me do it, because it was the first run made by someone else for Cyberpunk. So I had to get that into the full vision. And also when we were talking about doing a new box set, I was like, immediately imagine a lot of names coming to my head and of people I want to work with for writing new modules, or those already made for the gems, or new illustrators for these covers. So it's very cool to be able to do this, just to have these ideas coming together and making something new. It's one of the best feelings of being in this creative circle, is to have these ideas clashing in a good way, you know, just merging into something new. It's very cool.
Did you have any sort of input or design goals for the people that you're working with for this? Was it just, hey, I want you to write a scenario for this, have at it, do whatever you want? Or did you have kind of a shopping list, right? Did you say okay, we want to have one thing that focuses on this, has this sort of theme, has this sort of thing? Or, you know, did you just say, hey, these are the people I want to work with, they can write whatever the hell they want, let's get it together?
Well, basically the second, but we have some guidelines, because we had this meeting deciding more or less what we're going to do with Overload, and we decided that it should be divided into three parts. So that's how you see the three boxes. Each one is themed after an aspect of the cyberpunk genre. So the first one is the sprawl, based on urban crawls and running the city and factions, etc. And the other is tech, which is obviously the one of the main things about cyberpunk, the technology, the cyberware. And the other is the redacted aspect, which is weird stuff. We want to keep adding this, because I know, myself, many people like this weird stuff and SCP and Shadowrun things about cyberpunk as well. So we had these three teams, and when we invited these designers, we had some things that are more or less full and others are lacking a little. So we suggested them to work with that. It was not an obligation or something, but gladly they found a way to manage their ideas, their focus to what we needed, just to come together as equal parts, the three parts, equally, about six pamphlets each box. So yeah, it was not forced upon them. It was just a suggestion, and I'm glad that they come together with very exciting new stuff.
Just it's like the NFL draft. They're just all in a Discord call, and you're like, okay, so here's who's going to be writing the tech supplement.
Yeah, and we let that very open. If you want to do a run, we are fine with it. If you want to do just a gear list, no problem. New rules. You think there's something in Cyberpunk that you want to add from your own game, from your ideas. Some modular rules, we are okay with that as well. So yeah, they are mostly scenario settings that let you run a series of one shots or just one big blasting one shot. That's pretty cool. But you have a lot of gear lists as well. So yeah, a bit of everything.
and that brings me back to something that I meant to ask near the start. Actually two things I meant to ask at the start, because I noticed Ray called it CBR plus PNK. And that brought up a discussion I remember having with my friends about, like, somebody like, how do you think you say this? How do you think you're supposed to say this? And I'm getting a feeling from your reactions that this was a conversation at the very least.
I'm surprised we made it this far without broaching this topic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people just call it Cyber plus Punk. I feel like that's, you know, the that feels correct. But I also, as a person who at times can be very pedantic when I decide that I want to be, I do love the idea of being like, no, it's CBR plus PNK. Look at the book. Like, look, what does it say?
Yeah, I think most people call it Cyberpunk because of the lack of vowels.
That's it. So, it's Cyberpunk. That's it, officially.
Or, yeah. Or sometimes the punk becomes pink, which is okay as well, because when I decided to name it like that, I wasn't even imagine to reach what we have here. To reach, like, to having this product, this title coming to so many people's hands, mm-hmm. and in such a deluxe format. So yeah. If I had any idea, I would have chosen a better name, like a name more pronounceable. But I think that the initial idea was that there is an aspect of cyberpunk as a genre that it says about depersonalization and dehumanization. And one of the things that I've been noticing for decades is that names have been becoming just codes, just these shortened versions. Sometimes brands do that, just these short versions that almost resemble like just a code or an image, not a word, not something that exists in our world, but something that they want to bring as their thing, like, and this is something that I want to translate into this title, is that there is this entity that is cyberpunk that that's coming to you, like this thing. It's not cyberpunk, it's another thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to play with that. And the plus in the middle was like just me riffing off the idea of the system itself, where you use an approach plus a skill. And then it's like initially I was going to also have a version of each approach with three letters and each skill with three letters. And then you combine those three, those six, and you make your roll. But then coming up with these three letters for each skill, we have about 12, I think. So it was going to be a bit difficult. So I just decided to make the title like that, you know. And that's a way that I found to show somehow the system working with the title. It was a silly idea, but yeah, here we are. And fortunately, sometimes this brings to discussions, like you said, you had with your friends, and that's a way to make some marketing for the game, I guess.
It's a really organic conversation builder, right? It's like you see it on the shelf, and you're like, wow, look at this thing. And it's like, how do you think you say that? What do you think that is? I love it. Yeah. That's great. But the question I interrupted myself for, cyberpunk is based around one shots, you know, and it's kind of as a system And then, and also the runs, sort of, you're in it, you know, you're not doing this like rags to riches build up. I'm going to build the legend or whatever. It's one last job, or you're in the middle of the job, or whatever it is. Was that a thing that you had in your mind at the start of the design? You know, when you were hacking everything together, where you're like, this is going to be one shot, you know, quick hit design. You're going to get in, you're going to have a big explosive adventure, and you're going to be done. You know, was that sort of like, I'm going to make these pamphlets. The pamphlets are going to be quick hits. Boom, done.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because of the nature of the pamphlet being so short in space, I wouldn't have space for describing a campaign procedure. So initially the idea was just to run with my group that one night, and I had to make something just to cement the idea that we were doing that for just that night. And those characters we are not going to see those characters again. And I had this idea of, I saw it elsewhere, of course, having these epilogues where when the run finishes, the surviving characters would narrate their life after that thing. And of course, if they were successful, they would have paid all their debts or run from the criminals or the authorities they're hunting them. And that came into the pamphlet just a way for me to solidify this space as just like, okay, we have these rules, but we won't have a campaign, but at least you have some closure with this method of epilogues.
Yeah, I love that. I think a lot of people play, at least in my experience, that's what I'll say. Not a blanket statement, my experience. People tend to play one shots or two shots like far more frequently than it feels like the people who design the games think they do. You know, people love like, okay, here's your rules for advancement, and then you do this, and then it's like you actually get to the table and it's like, okay, take like two advancements, whatever. We'll just get through it, you know. we'll have characters that can do some interesting things real quick. And I think some games struggle in that, because I think some games want you to take your time with them and you know, build through the rules, and that's great. Don't take that as me saying that that's a bad thing. But I think it's interesting and exciting to see a game that's designed to say you're going to do this, make a character that's exciting now, you know, to make. Yeah. Who's the guy that looks cool at the end of the Cyberpunk campaign? You're that guy. Let's just get there. And, you know, in the classic parlance, you can drive it like you stole it, because it doesn't matter if he makes it to the end of the night. Have a good time.
Yeah, and that helps a lot to bring together the whole Forging the Dark thing about you burning your stress through the adventure. You knowing that the run is your last, you are more compelled to burn that stress, to be marked as a hunted, to take larger and more risks, you know, to face the threats with all you have. And that helps a lot, because the Forging the Dark system, it thrives in that. So it was really important to cement that process of making a game that's for one shot. And eventually we had written some smaller campaign rules. We have that in the framework brochure, which is on the base box. But that as well is like, it's framed like, which I took from Sean Litter, this idea of you are on your last run, but you are playing all the flashbacks for things you made to get there. Mm-hmm. So you can play like four or five runs, but within the flashbacks, and then you come back to the actual effect, and you see what you got. If you burn too bright, or if you fail something, and you finish with your oppressor. So yeah, there's that option as well. But always thinking about this is your last job, your last run. It was something that came out from the home game as well, because we wanted to play like this fast game, but playing Cyberpunk with just newbies characters, like just very low rank characters, is not as much fun in a one shot, you know, because you have all these possibilities, you have all these augmentations, but we are too poor, we don't have much money, don't have the creds, you know. It would be too oppressive, I think. So it was one of the things that decided, okay, these are veterans. These guys are, they know what they're doing. These augmentations are like the signature augmentations. They are the best. They are best adapted to that. So that was one of the factors that I decided upon that home game as well.
I like that. I think I think people always want to play really cool, exciting characters. And in the you know, sort of more traditional TTRPG like genre space, you know, it's why you have the big discussions about people that make, you know, level one characters that have this like 10 page backstory that are like, oh, I did all of these things. And it's like, well, but you're a level one fighter, which I have my own thoughts about this. We don't even talk about it here. That's a whole other thing. But it's because people want their characters to be nuanced and complicated and have conflicts and all of this. And, you know, you're playing a level one fighter. This is not the time for that. Hey, guess what? Cyberpunk, guess what? I'm super complicated. I blew up 17 buildings and everybody knows me because I've got this sick mantis arm. Done. In it. Go. Blow up a train. Put that on the box. Go blow up a train.
Go. Blow up.
Go, period. Blow up a train. This is a silly question for Ray. I gotta ask. This is the point in the episode where I just ask a silly question that's not related to anything, but I gotta know. As a person, you know, person, entity, company, you know what I mean, that publishes multiple games, like multiple game lines, multiple genres, multiple creators, do you feel just like a big proud mama bear feeling when you just like look out over all you survey, when like you look at all of the game lines, you look at like oh, look at everything, everybody playing all of our stuff? Or is it the other way where like you have your little favorites where it's like everybody's buying Wild Sea and you're like, why aren't you playing Cyberpunk? What's going on? What are you guys doing? Come on, buy some of these. What are you, because I'm on and you listen, this is a joke answer, don't feel pressure, but it's just I always think it's really, I think it's such a funny idea to be like, look at all of my books, why aren't you buying these books, what are you doing, buy some of these.
Yeah. I guess the answer is one of my guiding principles, you know, we don't publish anything that we don't want to play or have played before. So all of our games we've played extensively. Like, I've run more, to be honest, I've probably run more Cyberpunk than anything else, because just simply because it's so easy to bring with me wherever, and just like the portability factor is a huge factor. It's such a good con game. Just it's a great, like, oh hey, we have a couple hours free, it's late, you know, it's like 7-8 p.m. after the con, it's everyone's cool, we got a couple of beers, let's play a game, you know, like it's that type of game. That's amazing. But like, I so far all of our games have had like a common kind of DNA lineage, and that's like not necessarily by design. It's not like I'm saying, oh, I'm only going to publish certain types of game, but it comes from that, like, okay, well, I want to publish games that I want to play, and I come out from this specific kind of design school, which is kind of the Forge in the Dark community, and so, like, I have connected and played many of these designers' games. I know the mechanics intimately. I feel like I understand the design aspects comfortably. I can give input and understand, like, you know, whether or not it's like good or I like it or whatnot. So, you know, most of the designers have some relation to that school in a very like direct or indirect way. And also, like, now in 2025 versus like 2020, when, you know, when I got into that scene, things have evolved, right? And I think it's really cool seeing how things have evolved. And because Blades is such an influential game, like, we see it in so many places. Like, you know, we see the DNA in Blades and like Daggerheart, for instance, right? There's a lot of Blades in Daggerheart. And where are the possibilities, and like, what's cool in design today, and like, where are the exciting kind of like nodes of like micro communities where people are talking constantly and sharing designs? Like, that's what I'm interested in as a publisher and as a designer. I love seeing where people are excited, and I love seeing people taking these ideas that exist and then like pushing them forward or like going in like one direction or another. Like, for instance, one of the things that I'm seeing now from the Blades designers or kind of that school is like a lot of the newer designs don't even have dice rolls. Like, a lot of it is just taking the idea of like the devil's bargain that exists in Blades and like using that as like almost the resolution system entirely, where it's all like almost like a Polaris style negotiation between like the GMs and the players, where like, well, you can succeed, but it's going to cost you or whatever, right? And like kind of layering on complexity that way, but having it interact in an almost like if-then statement kind of way, which I find really, really fascinating. So yes, I'm very proud of all of the games that we publish. I try to, like, one of my goals too is like I want to like connect everybody more. So like I try to connect like the designers with each other more, and not just across like the actual like people on the box, but like, say, layout artists and like cover artists and like, you know, people who have various specialties. Like, I'm always trying to like think of projects that they could work on and collaborate on, even if it's like on a one-off basis, even if it's like a cover or like, oh, just do this pamphlet or whatever, because I think that's what I'm kind of good at, is that like I want to bring people together, and I want to form like these groups and have people work on projects to create things that are greater than the sum of its parts, and that's what really gets me excited as a publisher. Like, that's really like that's what I'm at, like, my most proud is like, oh, like we did this, you know, like we created like some things that are extremely amazing. I'll give you an example. So Emmanuel did the Firefly folio for Wildsea, and like, you know, obviously Emmanuel's busy right now doing Cyberpunk Overload. So like, me and Vince and Felix, the creator of the Wildsea, we're like looking at it, right? And we're like, we're not like that sloppy of designers. I mean, certainly I'm like kind of the weakest of them all, like, but jack of all trades kind of, but like Vince is pretty good, right? But like, we're looking at the Firefly folio and we're like, damn, this is really good. Damn, this is gonna be real hard to like replicate, you know, but like that's what kind of gets me jazzed. It's like seeing people you know, recognizing their talents and trying to like platform them a little bit. Like, somebody that I'm really excited to work with on this project and on future projects is there's a designer called Jack Panic, Dungeon Club, who I think has some like really, really freaking cool designs that he's done in the past. And I'm really, really excited to see like where he can take this pamphlet format and like, you know, put his like kind of two cents and his design sensibilities on it. So yeah, that's like what excites me. Like, definitely like a proud like kind of mama bear moment across like all of the designs and grabbing people, just people that I like play games with, that I've talked like game design with, that like, you know, I follow on TikTok, that like, you know, like the more I do this and the more that I guess I my role evolves in MythWorks and like what we do, it's like half the time I'm just like networking these days. I just network more and more. Like, I like take meetings and then I you know, make social media and then I, you know, send emails and stuff like that. So but that's cool, and I think that's kind of interesting. So that's kind of what I try and do, and then I also try to like, you know, give my two cents, but I try to have like a very like a Zen or like Taoist philosophy about it. Like, gosh, okay, this is like a deep cut, but there was, did you ever watch read Animorphs back in the day?
Absolutely.
Okay, do you ever read the Elemis Chronicles?
No, that's the spinoff, right?
Yeah. So they had a series of like spinoffs for specific characters, right? It was like, okay, we're going to do longer books that go into the backstory of these specific characters. And the Elemist is like the godlike character in Animorphs, right? He's like the force of good, basically, like this highly involved, like being that is like helping the Animorphs for some mysterious reason. And like the Elemis Chronicles goes into the backstory of this character, and turns out when this character was like a teenager and hadn't like ascended yet and become like godlike, he played a game where it's a game of evolution. So essentially it's like Spore or Civilization, and the goal of the game is to have as small of an impact as possible to like butterfly effect, to create like the strongest civilization, right? So like you would do like one small change, and like your opponent would do like a similar change or whatever, and then they would eventually like clash the civilizations. But like the way they like got a high score in the game was by having like the smallest impact, right? Like by doing like the littlest thing and watching it cascade down. And that's kind of what I think of like as my job sometimes, is like when I give like feedback or whatever, like I'm trying as hard as I can not to like, you know, be dictatorial or directorial about things, or be like, oh, you should do this or whatever. I'm just trying to like have as small of a impact as possible that hopefully like cascades and inspires is kind of like my goal when I like talk to people.
Yeah, I get that. You want them to do what they're doing, but you want to like help guide them in you know the proper direction. You want to help, you know, just sort of shape it more than,
yeah,
hey, here's what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not sure if that answered the question.
No, I appreciate, I made a really silly question, and then you gave like a really good, like heartfelt, detailed answer. And that's great, because I made a goof, and then you... Yeah, I made a goofy question about like, do you feel like your games fight? And you were like, here's my philosophy as a publisher. here's the way a novel I read as a young child has influenced my viewpoint. And I'm like, damn.
By the way, that novel was Animorphs.
Yeah, and by the way, it was Animorphs. Animorphs is good. People, listen. It's 2025. If you haven't read Animorphs, read Animorphs. It's good.
Good fucking stuff, man. It's good
Kay
stuff.
Kay Applegate is out here. She's real. She knows what's up.
Shout out to Everworld. Did you ever read Everworld? Everworld, no. her other series? Okay, so get this, right? So the Elemis had that bit about like the cascading evolution. The Everworld is about a world of gods, right? And there's an alien god that's eating all the other gods, and these kids get transported, these teenagers get transported into this world. But the key differential, like one of the lines in there, is that the difference between a god and a human is that when you become immortal, you become stuck in your ways. You never change. You're the paradigm of whatever it is, right? And that's always stuck with me. Like, all these years later, I'm like, oh, that's such a cool way of defining it. It's like a god is just always, like, they're always going to act like, Aphrodite is always going to act like Aphrodite. Zeus is always going to act like Zeus, right? And I'm like, oh, that's such a cool way to think about it.
I'm still looking at that. I'm going to write that down. I always come out of these interviews with like three or four things just scribbled in the bottom of my notebook of like, look into this, read this book, whatever. I love it. This is why I love doing the show. Just Ray's so excited to talk about these books. I love it. it makes my heart happy. That's why I love this show. I just have to appreciate that moment for a minute. It's just sometimes, what's he doing?
I kept it, you know. I kept it after all these years. I was like, it's all my
that old Scholastic copy. I love it.
Yeah.
it makes me wish I had my old Animorphs. I know they're reprinting them, but there's just the old layout that they used to have, just big chunky colors. I love it. So I know we've got a time thing. So sadly, this will have to be a little shorter. But as always, more than happy to have one or either of you back, because you know, just doing the show is fun, and I love chatting with everybody I get a chance to. Let's dive into homework. So for people who don't know, homework is a little bit for a little bit of a chance for the guest to talk about stuff they're excited about, put more things in front of you, more things they want to shine a light on, more things that they want to say, hey, here's a cool thing you should check out, in the same way that the podcast is me saying, here's a cool thing that you should check out. So Emmanuel, why don't we start with you? You can talk about what you're excited about.
Yeah. First thing, watch Andor, guys. Everyone, Andor, because especially in these times, it's like it says a lot about how fascism ingrains in society, and everyone involved or not suffers from it. So yeah, it's also a masterpiece in storytelling and some of the best acting in the last decade. So there is one particular scene, I don't want to talk which scene, but there's one particular scene that's like the best monologue of all time, in my opinion. So yeah, it's very good. It's Disney, but you can always, it's always morally correct to download it. And no problem.
I agree.
So, yeah, watch Andor. And it's I finished it recently. I was a bit late for the last episode, but it's still stuck in my mind, and it keeps coming, especially from the last week, the things going on in LA. So yeah. And the second thing is Snow Crash. It's a cyberpunk book. It's one of the seminal cyberpunk books from the 80s. It's one of the best cyberpunk books out there, and I've been reading it, like actually listening to it. So I'm here to recommend, if you like cyberpunk, you haven't read it yet. It's not as big as a name as Neuromancer or Androids, but it's, I think it's like the best. It has some sort of punchy, short, jargon heavy lines, like the jargons that he creates for this book. It becomes like the staple for cyberpunk jargon, and the writing style, it's, to me, it's like the best representing the genre. So yeah, Snow Crash, a very, very cool story of a character called Hero Protagonist, which is a really funny name, but he's so badass. He's so badass, but also he's so broke. He's so funny. Yeah, it's very satirical, but has some very cool stuff. And there's this whole, the cyberspace in there, it's called I think it's the, like, meta space, something like that. So from probably where Zuckerberg stole the idea for the thing, because people buy the properties there, buy the land there, and build their homes there. It's a whole thing. It's a very fun book, and for those who like cyberpunk, it's a must. Yeah,
I agree. I remember reading Snow Crash, actually longer ago than I probably thought about 2 seconds ago when I realized when I actually read it. But yeah, no, I agree. I think I exactly like you said, I think people don't recommend it as much as some other works, but I also feel like it is in some ways more applicable to the world that we find ourselves in now than some of the themes that show up in more traditional cyberpunk media. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. And Ray, I think it's totally fair. We could just put Animorphs. We could start with unofficial asterisk Animorphs.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I yapped about Animorphs, specifically the Elemis Chronicles and Everworld earlier. I was going to say Andor too, plus one to everything that Emmanuel said. I mean, Andor is great. It's so prescient to our times, and, you know, adds, or I don't want to say adds because it was always there, but, like, you know, explores, like, these elements of Star Wars that, you know, that just make it feel so much more real, right? I think, like, the It's like it's the adult version of Star Wars, where it's like Star Wars, you know, you go into the good and evil, and then like real Andor is really just like a rumination on like what is evil, like how does evil come about, right? Which I think is really, really fascinating, and it's just so good and so well done. And then the last thing I'll mention is I spent the week last week with my my sister's family in Salt Lake City, and I was surprised that like none of them had seen Atlantis, The Lost Empire. So I was like, oh, let's watch Atlantis, The Last Empire, the Disney movie from 2002, I think. And while watching it, I was like very, I was kind of shocked to realize like how much of like MythWorks stuff is in like that one movie. I'm like, oh, like I guess this is where I got a lot of the ideas from Glow from, like subconsciously. And like I guess like Felix really loves Atlantis too, because dang, this movie is hecka Wild Sea coded. Or Wild Sea is hecka Atlantis coded, I should say.
Right, the other way.
So yeah, I mean so like another like random random thought I had. So it's like it's really interesting to me, like adult animation, right? So like there was a period of time where two things could have become really, really big but didn't. Steampunk was one of them. So there was Treasure Planet, there was Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and there was Titan AE, which is more sci-fi, but you know, kind of has like these cool vibes. So all three of these movies came out within, I think, 2 or 3 years of each other. And all three of these movies represented a push from American animation studios to become more action-oriented, more like a little bit more mature. Like they're still kids' movies, obviously, but they're coded to be, you know, like action adventures, right? And would have pushed animation in more of that direction, which you see from like Japan and so on and so forth. And you know, there was major money behind these movies. These are all like $100 million plus budgets, and they all failed. Well, one after another, right? And they killed the steampunk genre, and they killed adult or more action animation for forever, basically. And it's interesting to see like them all be in the zeitgeist around the same time, being like, yeah, let's make like these cool steampunk sci-fi like Jules Verne-esque movies, and all of them failing simultaneously. And I have a theory. I think 9/11 is a huge part of like why those things never took off, but it's so interesting to see that like, okay, all of these directors and creatives and animation studio heads or whatever, they all like collectively said like, yeah, steampunk's gonna be a thing, and then it wasn't.
I like your thought, and I agree. I think specifically like American animation and film and like television, like I don't think some people realize the effect that 9/11 and sort of the ideas and the like where people's heads were at after 9/11, like I don't think they realize how much that shifted the tone and the content and the trajectory of a lot of things. You know, I'm sure some people do, but I think a lot of people just haven't kind of examined where we were when that happened, like in terms of media, and then just the kind of like big jagged push that came out after that. And God, Titan AE was really good. I feel like Titan AE is one of those things that comes up every so often on Tumblr that people go like, oh, Titan AE was really good, and it's like, yeah, it is, it was, everyone should watch it.
Yeah, and nobody watched it at the time.
And I don't know when the last time I thought about Atlantis was, like, honestly, like I like you say that and I go, oh yeah, that movie rules. I don't know when the last time, yeah, I like actually thought about it.
My sister's family, they're huge Disney fanatics, right? Like every time they visit LA, they go. Like I only go to Disneyland when my sister's family is in town, but they come every 2 years or so, and so I go very often. And they're such Disney fanatics. And I was so surprised, like none of them had seen it. I was like, I thought you guys watched all the Disney movies. How did you not? How did this one, like,
how did you miss this? Yeah. I love that. That's great. Yep. More, yeah, gosh, I'm thinking about like that specific era of animation and stuff. Like, God, it could have been something. You're absolutely got me. I'm gonna go on a rabbit hole of like searching and watching stuff on YouTube now. Dang it, Ray, come on. I gotta do some work this afternoon. You ruined it. Mad
shucks.
But all right, that would be I'm getting ahead of myself. That's not the podcast. Now we're to the final question. This is why you wrap up a little early, because you know you've got a final question to do. So this is the three question. This is the question neither of you knew was coming. So at the end of the first episode, I asked my guest, the Amazing Star, what her top three guests to be on the podcast would be. And ever since then, I've asked every guest the top three something that we come out. I just come up with it over the course of the podcast. When we've had two guests before, I've trimmed it down and say each of you only have two, or you can collectively decide on three, however you want to do it, because asking each of you to do three is a pretty big endeavor. I want to have the same. Okay, here's what we'll do. Collectively, come up with three. Who are, this is a fun, interesting question based on stuff that we've talked about. Who are the top three people in the entire TTRPG industry, right? At any point, who are the top three people you would love to have work on a cyberpunk pamphlet?
You want to go on that one?
That's what I'm thinking.
You go on that one. Do you take this one? take one and two at least, or one, and I'll fill in what's left.
You know what? There is one person that didn't make into Overload that I would love to see what this person could do with Cyberpunk, which is Mikey Ham, the creator of Slug Blaster. I think he would have made something really fun. Really fun. Riley Daniels is also another name. She's been probably very busy working with As the Sun Forever Sets, which is a book coming by Evil Hat. But I love her work. I love the stuff she's putting out, and it would be a blast to work with her. Right?
Okay, so I'll do the super pie in the sky answers. Lord Skurlock himself, John Harper, I think would have been, it's an obvious choice, right?
Sure,
like he,
sure.
see what he would have done with it, and especially because he's like so good with his graphic design too. I'm sure he would have pumped out something like amazing. And then I will say, it's a bit of a cheat, but I'll say Matt Pondsmith or Corey Pondsmith. It would have been really, really cool to see what the OG Maximum Mic would have done with Cyberpunk. And I know Corey bought a copy of CBR plus PNK. I'm not saying that means that Talsorian endorses what we're doing it anyway.
But Corey did buy a
copy. Yeah, but Corey did buy a copy.
Just so. I know he has one, so
yeah.
We gotta put him in the door. We can figure it out.
Yeah. shout out to our Talsorian in general. I mean they make awesome stuff, and Corey's a real sweetheart.
No, I love that. I'm always curious with especially when people have stuff that they've designed that people are already contributing to and all of this. It's just like who's that person that you could just cherry pick? Like you just have you've got that magic ticket that is like, no, they will say yes. Who do you pick? And yeah, gosh, those are God. Having Mikey do's, oh, that would be really good. I don't know if that would have been in my top five guesses, but that would be fantastic. Gosh, it'd be such a different vibe too. It would be.
Yeah, for sure.
He had a great thread. Did you see his thread recently on the Slug Blaster AP? He had such a great thread talking about how and it's in the same way that doing this podcast like always answers questions that I've had that just never had the chance to talk to the right people about. He talks about how he feels, you know, people misunderstand Slug Blaster because he views it as a grounded game that's also sometimes silly. And he finds that people approach it the other way, where it's silly and sometimes grounded. And like he almost like talks it through in the thread in a way that I think is so interesting and vulnerable to see from a creative. Like I always am so excited to see creative people talk through their process, talk through their thoughts, talk through their feelings about their own work, especially in a sort of a public setting like that, and kind of let people into their thought process for that. So yeah, big shout outs to Mikey. Mikey's great. Slug Blaster's amazing.
Yeah. What I always say about like Slug Blaster and Mikey is that like Mikey, Slug Blaster is, in my personal opinion, I think from that generation of like Forge in the Dark games, which is the greatest generation, obviously, is the most like well designed. Like he put that system through its paces, man. Like, and he tested every single thing and got rid of everything that he didn't need to, and derived on this like simplicity of this elegance and simplicity that you don't see very often, especially for hacks of that stuff, but just in games in general. And I think it's interesting to hear him say that, or that being his take, because like it kind of reflects Mikey as a whole, because like outwardly he's kind of like, you know, like just big lovable dad at this point, but like lovable dad who at some point was like a degenerate and like, you know, skater slash like punk rock, like, you know, band member and whatnot. But like, and that's kind of how he like presents himself, but actually he can be like really deep. He is really deep with his, you know, philosophy, his design and all that stuff. It's just like, you know, it's just behind this like neon, like pink aesthetic exterior that people are just like, oh yeah, get slime, bro. You know?
It's, yeah, it was such a fun thing to like stumble on and see people talking about and see him sharing thoughts. And I think it's great. I think it is exciting when, as a fan of someone's creative work, you have the ability to experience more of like them as a person. And this is exciting. Cool. But that is officially the end of the podcast. Everything we talk about will be in the show notes. Summer Plus Punk Overload on Kickstarter now. Hopefully by the time you hear this, I mean, hopefully very, very soon, but also hopefully by the time you hear this, it will have met its goal and we'll start smashing those stretch goals. Which I gotta say, I love seeing that a good number of those stretch goals are just, we pay everybody more. Cause that's great to see. That's always fun to see those stretch goals hit. It's just like, oh good, everybody's gonna make a little bit more money. That's always fun to see. But yeah, I'm a big hopes for this campaign. I hope we get everything unlocked. And you know, I hope we get everything unlocked and we get our three little boxes. Fingers crossed. You know, yeah. if it's gotta be one, it is what it is. But come on, three little boxes, get in the comments. But Ray, Emmanuel, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I always appreciate people making time in their schedules to come on the show and talk about all their stuff. You know, as I always say, I have a great time doing the podcast. I have a great time sitting down and chatting with folks, and I hope people had a good time listening. But yeah, everything will be linked in the show notes. Go to MythWorks, buy MythWorks stuff, go buy Wildsea. I meant to ask Ray about Wildsea more. I didn't. It's great. You should buy it. It's a cool book. It's full of great stuff. Go buy it. Stop giving fucking Wizards of the Coast your money. Go buy Wildsea. God damn it. But that's going to be the rest of it. Again, thank you so much. Go ahead. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Here we are in the outro. I want to thank Ray and Emmanuel so much for making time to sit down on the podcast. Scheduling two people is a little bit trickier than just scheduling one, but I really think it is always worth it if it's two people who have worked so closely together on a project, like we've done every time we've done it. Cyber Plus Punk Overload is live on Kickstarter for another 2 weeks. You should go back it. There's a tier where you can get the original game and the expansion in physical and digital at an incredible price point. I definitely recommend you grabbing it if you're a fan of TTRPGs, if you're just getting started in TTRPGs. I think this is, I don't like the term beginner TTRPG for a lot of reasons, but I think this is a really good entry-level game for a lot of reasons. I think this game does a whole of a lot with a heck of a little and is a masterpiece of a physical product design. Links to places you can keep up with Emmanuel and MythWorks will be in the descriptions. You can check them out. You can also follow the show on Blue Sky and Instagram. Links to that will be in the description, as well as the Patreon. I redid the Patreon recently. There are 10 limited spots for $3 a month to help me cover hosting cost. The Patreon is completely free. You get access to an audio and all of the video episodes. But if you support, you get access to whatever small extras I decide to put out and little behind the scenes clips whenever they pop up. Nothing big, but as the point of the show is to help creatives talk about what they're doing and in essence market their stuff, I didn't want to hide anything like that behind a paywall. I don't ever want to push the Patreon too hard, but honestly, if those server costs could get covered, that would be a big weight off of my mind. But know that listening and rating the show means the world. And don't forget, thanks to our friends over at Plus One EXP, listeners of the show can get 10% off of the Plus One EXP store, either physical or digital, or 10% off of your first month of Zine Club. I actually just got the email for the new month of Zine Club. I got to check those out. If you use the code WDPodcast, all one word, at checkout. Again, that's 10% off of your cart, physical or digital, or 10% off your first month of Zine Club. I've got a couple episodes in the can to finish up, and I've got some exciting and potential interviews on the horizon. So I'm going to go work on those, and I'll see you in the next one.